Greetings, regular and new listeners. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden. You can follow us online and worldwide at redicecreations.com. And if you've heard a few of our recent programs with, for example, Andrew Bashago, Robert Bouval, or Alfred Weber, you know that we've been talking about anomalies, structures, and in some cases even what looks like statues that have been found on Mars. We've also talked about life on Mars, of course, and other things as well have been coming up. We are going to continue on that theme here today and talk about the exploration of unusual structures found on Mars, primarily within the boundaries of the Cydonia area. We have a director and associate director of the Cydonia Institute with us. George J. Haas and William R. Saunders is with us on the line. They have written the Cydonia Codex, Reflections from Mars, released back in June 2005. And they have a new book out now called The Martian Codex, More Reflections from Mars, released just about a month ago. Their website is simply thecydoniainstitute.com. That's the place to go, where you can find articles, more information about the research, forums, and about their books, of course. So with that, we can begin to say hi and welcome to George Haas here first. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio, George.
Well, thank you for inviting us. We look forward to it.
Excellent. Good to have you with us. Now we know what you sound a little bit like, George, and we also have William Saunders with us on the other end here. Hi, William, and thank you for joining us as well here today.
Hi, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. And maybe you guys can share with us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in the work that you're doing today over at the Cydonia Institute. George, maybe you would like to begin.
Yes. I started getting interested in the structures and formations on Mars in a book by Randolfo Pozos. He had a book out in the late 1980s, which was titled The Face on Mars, Evidence for a Lost Civilization. I had picked the book up and, in a bookstore, obviously, and I was thumbing through it, and I was pretty amazed. I had remembered The Face on Mars from when I was in high school, actually, that summer, getting out of high school, graduating, going to college. It was the summer of 1976 when they had all the images come down from Mars and, of course, the famous Face on Mars. But hadn't thought much about it for a long time until I saw the book by Puzo. And after reading that, I was very intrigued, and looking at some of the other formations that I hadn't even known about in the Cydonia area, I was basically convinced from that point on that there was something extraordinary going on in the Cydonia area.
And was it shortly after that you started your website, or is that fairly recently in terms of your research?
What I did initially was I had a few, after I introduced them to the book, and we put together a group called the Cydonia Institute in 1991. And we eventually found out about Richard Hoagland, and we ordered the Monuments of Mars video. And we actually at one time had what we called the Mars Party, invited a lot of people over, and we showcased Richard Hoagland's video. And it was pretty interesting, and we got a lot of support. And we started out as a small group, and we were basically doing research, trying to figure out, you know, what these structures were all about. We didn't have a website until much later after I met Bill.
And William, when did you come aboard, and what was it you who were the initial thought behind the website, so to speak, and got that started?
I'm not exactly sure when the website got started, but it was after we had George and I had met and began our research. I had like George, I had become interested in around 1991 when I was introduced to Richard Hoagland's work, and I didn't pursue anything too much other than following what Hoagland had done, and until the Mars Observer the Mars Global Surveyor in 1998, and when it released its first images of the Cydonia area, including the new image of the face, that's when I started to really become interested and started to observe some things in Cydonia that I perceived to be artificial. My background is actually in the physical sciences. I work as a petroleum geoscience consultant, and I have a background from the University of Alberta in Edmonton in geomorphology, which is the formation of the Earth's structures. And so I was seeing a lot of stuff that I was trying to relate to processes on Earth, how it would form, and it was very, very puzzling. I knew there was something that just wasn't fitting together right there. And that's when I met George on Richard Hoagland's Enterprise Mission website on a forum there. We had both been coming across things that were very unusual, and we kind of met on that forum, and it sort of snowballed from there. And I think it was within a year that we created our first website.
Yeah, and when we put the website together, it was initially it was going to be underground, and it was only going to be sent to other researchers to do analysis, you know, because we were trying to figure this out before we went public with anything. So basically, it was for our eyes only, and other invited guests to go look at it. It wasn't really a public website.
I see. And it seems then that you guys primarily have been focusing on the Cydonia region, and that's something I want to talk about here later on. But I want to just ask you right away here about the face, actually, because to me at least, it seems like the older images we have of the face seems to be more clear, maybe not resolution-wise, considering the difference in technology, but the new images that have gotten back to us, the face seem almost kind of smudged. I've even read somewhere that it's been suggested that it's been bombed or tampered with in some way. Does any one of you guys want to comment on that, and what you think the main differences are between the old and the new images of the face on Mars?
I wouldn't mind just commenting quickly that what George and I have found with these structures is that they carry multiple images, and they are meant to be viewed from above, but they change their appearance with the altitude. So the initial face that the Viking orbiter, or the initial picture of the face that the Viking orbiter took in 1976 was from 1,000 miles up, and as everybody who has seen it knows, it looks very much like a human face. But as you get closer, the Mars Global Surveyor, I think, was about 250 miles above the surface, and you can start to see more detail. And these structures are very much like mosaics in that they're not actually, a lot of the images aren't sculpted into it as so much as they are like a mosaic, so that when you view them from a distance, they you can see what they are. But as you get closer, the image starts to disappear in the detail. And that's what has confused a lot of people, because they're looking very closely at the face and they're not seeing what is meant to be seeing, because they're looking too close. It's like staring, holding the palm of your hand up to your eye and trying to see your entire hand.
Interesting point. George, anything to add to that?
Yes. Continuing what Bill said, initially when the face on Mars was taken, we all tend to forget that the right side of the face was completely in shadow, basically. And a lot of the images that you see in the media, it's even darker, so you're basically just seeing half the face. And it does appear, you know, the angle of the camera, that it did appear to have like a football helmet type of look to it, and like a human face. And people from that point on, they had an image in their head about what the face was. You know, people were already making assessments without having clear pictures. And once we got better pictures, that whole illusion that the face was a symmetrical human face, kind of looking like Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley, it evaporated, because the face on Mars is basically a bifurcated face, which Richard Hoagland showed early on with the not only the Viking image, but he also continued doing the duplications of the left and right side, showing the humanoid and the feline side. So people that perceive the face to be a human-looking Western ideal of a symmetrical face, once they see what the reality of the face is, a lot of them lost interest, because it was a concept that they were not familiar with. And this was the same problem that Bill and I had early on with looking at the face. We couldn't make any, you know, terrestrial connections initially, until I had gone to the museum here in Washington, D.C. They had an exhibit about the Olmec, and I first was exposed to bifurcated mask of Mesoamerica. And I saw that the same idea that Richard Hoagland was talking about with this bifurcated face, you know, not being a symmetrical Western ideal, was exhibited in this Mesoamerican art. So right from the beginning, we were making this connection with Mesoamerica, being showing an analogy that we could do with these archetypes that we're showing half faces in Mesoamerican art, looking very similar to these half faces that we're seeing on Mars.
We have a few images, by the way, linked up on redeyescreations.com that our listeners can follow along in as we discuss some of these features and so forth. And the first one that you guys sent me is obviously of the face. So again, just to reiterate, I guess you guys are saying here that the two-sided aspect of the face here is a potentially consciously incorporated feature, so to speak. And there are similarities to civilizations here on Earth. So is that the most clear connection right away, that this is a sculptured face? It's not just a geological feature that has arisen, but it's actually a consciously created face here. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, and the new image that we're providing, I guess it's image A, which is the high-rise image of the Sidonia face, which was taken in 2007. The face that you're seeing there, it shows great detail of the feline side, which is on the eastern or the right side. You can see the feline eye, the mane, the muzzle, the mouth, the tongue. It's got a little crown top crest at the top. On the left side, you can see the amazing detail of the eye, which has an iris. I mean, it's an amazing feature there that the face has, showing this human eye-looking feature. So the left side is basically a human or a humanoid type of face, which you're showing this duality of human and feline. NASA's taken over 20 images of the face. And what we're seeing, and what Bill could tell you also, is that this is a permanent formation. These features don't disappear every time NASA takes a different picture. The features that we're seeing and that we're looking at, they're permanent. They're there in all of the images, and they don't disappear with, you know, adjustments of light and camera angle. Anything to add, Bill?
The only thing I would say is that the structure itself, as George is saying, the features don't change, but there is as I mentioned, there is a change in their appearance as you view from different altitudes and different lighting. It's my contention that a lot of the structures in Sidonia are will have multi appearances as we see them at different times and different lighting. If people are familiar with the Maya pyramid in Chichen Itza, at the equinox in the spring and fall, you can see a serpent being created by the shadow. The head of the serpent is a permanent feature at the base of the pyramid, and then at the equinox, the angle of sun creates the body of the snake. And it's my contention that we see similar things going on with these structures on Mars, that depending on the angle of the light, they give you a different image.
Do we know how big the face is, let's say in miles or kilometers, if we were to measure it from top to bottom? Do you guys know if that has been, if we've found that out yet?
Yeah, well, Richard Hoagland, we've sort of gone by his research. I think I have measured it, but it's about a mile long, which is, a kilometer, a little over a kilometer, and a mile and a half high. And so its width would be, you know, maybe a kilometer wide.
Wow, that's really, really big. So if we go more, I guess, in the area of trying to find out how this was made then, do you guys suggest that this has been made by a native population on Mars, let's say many thousands of years ago, or are we looking at something more recent? Any theories or suggestions in regards to this?
Bill?
We kind of subscribe to Zachariah Sitchin's work. His work has documented the writings of the Sumerians. His translations seem to indicate that there was a race of beings came to Earth many thousands of years ago, and they had a way station on Mars, and they populated Earth, and probably they are the ones that created these structures, because as George and I have found, the mythology, the religious and mythology of the Central Americans, particularly the Mayan, the Olmec, their artistic work of their religious beliefs is almost duplicated in these Martian structures. So I think that the Martian structures came first, and somebody introduced these structures to the Mesoamericans, and then they created their mythology around these structures.
That's really, really interesting. And you guys have chosen, I guess, then to focus on this one area, the Cydonia area. Is there any particular reason for that, or is this just the fact that the most anomalies and structures that seem to suggest intelligent design are within that area, or is it for any other reason that you guys chose to focus on this?
Well, we started with the Cydonia area basically because of a face on Mars, and then in that area, with, you know, from the book that Puzo put out, The Face on Mars, Evidence for a Lost Civilization, he discussed some of the other formations in the area, like the D&M Pyramid. So that was our focus of our attention from the beginning. Like Richard Hoagland and a lot of other researchers that look at Mars, they stayed in this one area called Cydonia because that's where the face was, and there appeared to be all these other structures in the area. And in our first book, The Cydonia Codex, we just focus on the Cydonia area. But the new book that just came out, The Martian Codex, the first half of the book is dedicated again to the Cydonia area, but then we move out into the other regions of Mars, finding similar geoglyphic formations that also have this relationship to Cydonia and the Mesoamerican cultures.
Do you guys think that there's any comparison in terms to sites here on Earth then as well? You mentioned obviously the Mesoamerican culture, but I'm reminded of some of the other research out there that, for instance, there is an area primarily around Lebanon into Syria, around Tyre and so forth, that is called Sidon, and they suggested that there's links between Cydonia on Mars and Sidon here on Earth. Do you guys go into that at all, or are you primarily focusing on the Mesoamerican culture as the connection?
I haven't heard of that relationship here on Earth, but what we've been doing is, you know, we haven't made any conscious, pursuit of a preconceived agenda. You know, we've basically just followed the data. And from the beginning with the face on Mars, when Richard Hoagland did his duplication of the 1998 image of the face on Mars, the humanoid side had this tri-leaf symbol on the forehead. And a lot of early researchers were making the comparison to the Egyptians because the humanoid side appears to have this flange headdress. While doing some research, of course, spurred by my trip to Washington, D.C. with the Olmec exhibit, I realized or discovered that the Maya and the Olmec used the same tri-leaf symbol on their forehead and their headdress, which symbolized corn. And it was almost identical to the one that we found on the face on Mars. So that's how we initially got into this whole idea of possibly these archetypes that we were seeing were related to Mesoamerica. The face on Mars, also on the humanoid side, seems to have no nose formation, not a strong nasal cavity or anything on that side. It's very, almost looks damaged. That's why earlier you mentioned that the face might have been damaged or bombed or something was altered. But we found that the nose is basically covered by a nose ornament, which is another iconographic motif used in Mesoamerica. This 1998 image that we looked at also with the tri-leaf symbol on the forehead, we looked at the tooth. There was evidence of a tooth in the front and had a little dot on it, kind of like another ornamentation. And again, this was the same type of motif that we found in Mesoamerica. And this idea of the face being related to Egyptian iconography because of the flanged headdress, again, with this research in Mesoamerica, we found that the early Olmec sculptures also had this similar Egyptian-type flanged headdress. Now, we're not saying that all of this stuff is directly, in one point we are saying it's directly related to Mesoamerican culture, but as Bill can attest to, through doing this research, we found that not only does this mythology come out of Mesoamerica with these similar iconography that we're finding on the face, these same myths are in Egypt and they're in the Sumerian culture. It's like a melding of these same stories that are repeated over and over. We did a lot of comparison of the mythologies in the first book, relating some of the stories in Mesoamerica that are very similar to stories from Egypt. So there seems to be this root story that all the different cultures use. The reason we're drawn more to the Mesoamerican culture is because it's just so blatant. And it's, I mean, they use the same bifurcated faces, the two-faced mask. They do a lot of composite art. We're finding the same type of gods and creation mythology that we're finding on these artworks on Mars. So it just seems easier to follow that path with the Mesoamerican connection. But like I said, these structures also can be found to be mimicking other cultures throughout the world, like in India, for instance.
Absolutely.
We do actually in our first book, the Cydonia Codex, we do cover the connection between Sidon in Lebanon and the basically the master builders who have they were credited with building Solomon's Temple, and they were the master builders, and their the Freemasons actually evolved out of that.
Well, we mentioned the Sidonians in the Bible. That's true.
Yes, because we found just to the west of the face, actually, a half glyph of a compass and square. When you duplicate the one side, when you mirror it, you get a compass and square. So that was extremely interesting to us, and so that kind of led us to search what the history of the Freemasons were.
Well, that's really interesting. Maybe we can talk more about that later on. Bill or George, if you'd like to comment on this, to kind of get it off the table, I guess. Do you guys still think there is activity on Mars, or whoever constructed these features are long gone? What's your take on this?
Personally, I think that there is still activity going on Mars. I believe that there's very likely underground sites where people are living. Now, whether they are Earthlings or whether they are the original inhabitants, as or the Anunnaki, as Sitchin says that the Akkadians called them. Whoever it is, I believe that they are still on there. I think some researchers have shown evidence of some changes from on the surface from year to year in the different pictures that some of the craft have sent back.
If you just quickly or talk more about this, I think that if Hoagland and together with Mike Barra, for instance, in their new book, talk about pretty much the secret space program and also actually the Masonic involvement in that a lot of the Freemasonic rituals, so to speak, or planting of the Masonic flag on the moon and so forth has been going on. And considering what you guys just mentioned about the square and compass, could it be that we have Masons on Mars running around now, or is there something else going on here?
Well, getting back to the compass and square that we found up there, it's surprisingly right out of Mesoamerican culture also. A compass and a square, they make a circle and, of course, a cube, a square, which are opposing forms. You have this duality. The symbol of the compass and square is basically the symbol of duality. And that's what we're finding in all these images, and that is at the heart of Mesoamerican mythology, is this whole idea of duality, a transformation idea. So we were surprised at first finding the compass and square, but once we were putting all the research together and making this make sense, we saw that it's a symbol right out of Mesoamerican culture, which they some of their monuments have these circles within a square.
Yes.
Which is basically a compass and square, same idea.
And George, do you think that there are certain Mayan glyphs, if we talk about the Mayans, for instance, that seem to be recurring in the imagery that you've spotted in Sidonia?
We're not finding any of the abstract glyphs, per se. We're basically, the whole Maya hieroglyphic language that they created, you know, their glyphs, were basically made from severed heads. So that may be one reason why we're finding a lot of these geoglyphs in the Sidonia area and in other places that are these big heads, you know, like the famous face on Mars. It's basically a half of a human face on one side and a feline on the other. The Maya produced these masks that were with this duality, these two-faced masks. And it's also in the writing system, they used a lot of heads, which comes again right out of their mythology about the hero twins, and one of them were decapitated. So this whole idea of decapitation falls right in line with their mythology, and it's in the writing system. So this is what we're finding in the glyphs, are basically these big heads that we're finding. It's a language.
Absolutely. And what more connections have you guys found out between Earth and Mars? Does it seem to suggest, Jen, that again, to reiterate that you mentioned that another civilization pretty much have potentially brought these iconic, almost archetypal images to Earth, and simply the Mesoamerican cultures, the Mayans or the Incas, Aztecs or Olmecs, then have picked up on this, so to speak, and consequently continued and carried on with this particular religion, if we can call it that. Do you guys think that's the case here, what we're looking at?
Well, it's hard to comprehend a civilization being advanced enough for space travel and carry the mythology that, seriously consider the mythology that we have, that the Mesoamericans considered, with all these different deities that represent different things. I don't think they're reality-based belief systems. I think they're symbolic. George has made a lot of discoveries in the connection with the agricultural gods of Mesoamerica and the changes in the seasons and that sort of thing. And George probably be able to speak more about that.
Comments, George?
Well, this whole mythology started with the Olmec. There was a lot of controversy between archaeologists with the Aztecs and the Maya camp and then the Olmec followers. When the Olmec culture was initially discovered, they didn't know what to do with it because it didn't fit into the storyline that the archaeologists were putting together with the history of the Maya, who were supposed to be this peaceful people and they were just stargazers. And of course the Aztecs were the evil ones that were later that were doing the sacrifice. And then they were thrown out of whack when they discovered all this Olmec culture. And a lot of early archaeologists thought the Olmec were just an offshoot of the Maya. And then they came to the realization that the Olmec were actually, thousands of years before the Maya. And this whole mythology that the Maya have that we can understand and read, because we have a lot of text and a lot of iconography in vases and things and stelas and monuments to read, unlike the Olmec, which is very limited. The more artifacts we're finding of the Olmec, just a couple of years ago, they had a big exhibit and a talk called a Maya Weekend up at the University of Pennsylvania about the Olmec influence of the Maya. And basically, the Olmec are the mother culture. That's where all the information came from. The Maya basically just took everything from the Olmec and made it their own, kind of like where the Romans took all the mythology from the Greeks, that type of adaptation.
Yes.
So we're finding that the Olmec are the root. And then, like Bill was talking about our discussion of Zachariah Sitchin, supposedly Mingasada went down to South America with his favorite group of humans that they made called the Black-Headed People, which many think were the Olmec, which are they have a lot of negroid features. But they were down in Mesoamerica. And possibly this connection with the Olmec and the ancient Sumerians and the Anunnaki, this is where this whole mythology comes from that was bestowed onto them from the Anunnaki. That's why they their whole history is basically the same that we're seeing mirrored up on Mars. I mean, that's all we can come up with. I mean, we'd have to go there and get our feet on the ground to find out actually what's going on. But we're just interpreting what we're seeing in these images, and to us it just seems to be overwhelming that there's this correlation between the artwork in Mesoamerica and these structures on Mars.
Absolutely. And could it be also that some of the, or more evidence rather for this, could be the fact that most of these geoglyphs aren't seen, so to speak, until we get up in the air? We didn't discover some of these features until we had balloons, airplanes, or even later satellite photography. Could that be an evidence that these people who made the glyphs actually were airborne. George or Bill, any comments?
Well, I think, yes, you would have to be the technology that has gone into creating these structures, because there are multiple images within these structures, and they're not, and they're at all different angles, and they're at all different sizes, that is, viewing distances as you zoom in or zoom out and rotate the structure, different images appear. So the knowledge that went into creating these things is very, very high, and the creation of them was very high tech. So it's not a primitive culture who built these. And the fact that they are so large and that they have to be viewed from high up, it's obviously it had to been a technologically advanced people who did it.
Absolutely. And what about if we talk a little bit about the mirroring aspect, so to speak, of this as well? Many of the faces will have to be mirrored or reduplicated in order to get them whole, or they're partial. The idea of mirroring half faces like that, is that acceptable in terms of if we look at it from an archaeological perspective?
Yes. Archaeologists use mirroring in their research with Mesoamerican artwork, especially Chavin art down in Peru and things like that, which, like Bill was saying, some of the structures we're seeing on Mars have these multiple images in them. You see the same type of motif and artwork down in South America, in the Maya culture, images within images, the same idea. And archaeologists will use a mirroring technique, but they don't call it mirroring. They'll call it duplication or reconstruction. They shy away from using the word mirroring. When people hear mirroring, of course, they think of Rorschach test, and it's just a bunch of silliness and trick of light. But this is an actual scientific tool that the archaeologists use, and we list in the new book many archaeologists that use this technique, but again, they call it duplication. So when we're mirroring anything in the new book, we use the phrase duplication. Now, the reason some of these things are just half images, this again comes right out of Mesoamerican culture. There's a lot of sculptures and jade figurines that are just half of an image, just half of a figure, half of a face. This idea comes from a ceremonial process when the lordship of the, say, a certain town of, let's say, Tikal, when the lord dies and they put him in the tomb, what they would do, take some of his personal artifacts and cut them in half. Like, let's say he had a jade figurine of one of the gods. They would slice it directly in half and bury one half with him in the tomb, and the other half would stay in the upper world. So you'd have one half of the spirit in the underworld and one half in the upper world. So this whole idea of things cut in half is, again, right out of Mesoamerican culture. And Bill and I have found numerous half-face images, not just like the face on Mars, which is a bifurcated face. We found other formations that are just half.
Very interesting. And what do you think the primary material, so to speak, is here that they've been using? Did they use the sand or the earth that is available around, or could it even be that it's a rock formation there already and they simply pile up material on top of this in order to get the necessary features?
Well, that's what we surmised at first, was that these structures were originally in place, and they were just altered to create the images. However, from what we've seen in other places on Mars, not just in Cydonia, there definitely appears to be, and I'm speaking in particular here about the parrot that I think George has presented you with a picture of that, where it appears that there has been excavation and then creation of, a structure from that material. We originally figured that this was all rock. However, some of the instruments that NASA has used to survey the Cydonia area, they call the features enigmatic. The material is enigmatic. In other words, they can't identify it.
And that's right, regarding the Parrot Formation. We have an image of that if we look at the second one that we received from you guys. And what about, why isn't this a natural feature, and the fact is that we spot this with our eyes, so to speak, and the brain does the rest of the work, so to speak, and we fill this in? Is there any other evidence here that seems to point towards the fact that this is a created feature?
Well, geologically, the body and the tail, the feathering pattern that you see in the body and the tail, at first glance, that looks like the strata created by an incising stream that you would see in a canyon such as the Grand Canyon, whereas the stream cuts in, it leaves a different layer of rock. However, that's the only feature, the body and the tail of the parrot, is the only structure that shows evidence of any incising fluvial erosion. The totally surrounding, the features surrounding, are all anomalous to each other. There's no evidence of an incising stream on the material above the parrot, or to the side, or to below. And you can see just below the parrot, you can see the duned, rippled appearance of the surface, which is where a sea or a marine area was originally in place. There is a huge impact crater to the northeast, or is it the northeast or southeast, George, of where the parrot is?
Well, the parrot's upside down, so it's probably north.
So there was,
we've inverted
there was,
it.
Yeah, so there was water there at one time. There is definitely evidence of water in place, but not of incising fluvial action. And then George will speak to the veterinary side of things.
Yes, go ahead, George. And if you can mention if you had any experts been looking at this.
And hopes. We're looking at the parrot, image B. We sent this image electronically and then 8x10 glossies to three veterinarians, one in New Jersey, one here in Virginia, and one in Ohio. And the one in Ohio, Dr. Susan Oros, she's a avian specialist, so, you know, she knows what a macaw and parrot looks like. And as a group, they came back with, are you sitting down? 18 points of anatomical correctness in this bird, which goes way beyond chance. They're talking about the beak, the lower jaw, there's the tongue feature, the eye, the head, the different texture from the head, from the body. There's the little foot down there that has all the joints in the right place. At the top of the bird, there's this the fluting, or you can see the feather shafts. It's just amazing. They were actually blown away, and they were well aware that they were looking at something that was on Mars, so it wasn't like we were trying to send them something and fool them. The other anomaly on the bird, you'll know, there appears to be, they didn't know if it was some type of wattle or what that was. My interpretation, following the Mesoamerican model, is that that's probably a dart from one of the Hero twins, who, going again back to the Mesoamerican mythology, the principal bird deity occupied the world tree. He sat at the top of the world tree, and he had stolen the sun, according to the mythology. Very similar to the American Indian story of the raven. I don't know if you're familiar with American Indian stories of the black raven stealing the sun.
Yes.
Same idea. Right. Well, the Maya had a similar story with the Hero twins, that the seven macaw, which was the principal bird deity, he also stole the sun. And Hunahou shot his blow dart and hit him in the jaw, right where this blow dart just happens to be on this parrot formation on Mars. And he fell down to the earth, and, of course, they retrieved the sun. But we just find it amazing that finding all this Mesoamerican stuff with the two-faced motifs, and then we're finding this full image of a parrot that just happens to have what appears to be a blow dart stuck in his jaw.
And the parrot is still within the Cydonia area, or is this elsewhere on Mars?
No, that is in an area called the Argiri Basin. The Argiri Basin, it's in another part of Mars. This is actually when we decided to move our research beyond the Cydonia area. This formation
is quite far south.
Right, this is in the southern area of Mars. Again, right next to a large water basin, which NASA's photographed many times, and they've actually taken three pictures of this parrot, and it retains its formation in all the different pictures, so it's not just something that's a trick of light, and we only have one image. This image that we're presenting to your viewers here and your people on the radio, this was just released this summer, which, again, is another interesting story with NASA. When Bill and I were on Coast to Coast Radio, when our first book, The Cydonia Codex, came out back in 2005, we appeared on Art Bell's Coast to Coast with George Norrie on August 22nd. And that very day, Mike Malin, which runs the NASA photographs, the release of them, and he's the one that runs the camera, Michael Malin on his website he puts out an image of the day. He's been doing this for years. And usually those images are like from the last 6 months that have come down from the Mars Global Surveyor, and he'll put an image up and it's like the image of the day. Well, the interesting thing is this image was taken in 2002, and the night that Bill and I were on Coast to Coast, he put this up as the image of the day, the same day we were on Coast to Coast, which we thought was kind of interesting considering we had sent him a request to take another picture of this formation through a friend of ours, Jim Miller, who's also part of the Cydonia Institute, another colleague of ours, because we wanted to get a comparison. You know, Bill being a geomorphologist, of course, you wanted to get the analysis so he could look at the different strata and see if this was a legitimate formation or it was just a trick of light. So we did get that second image, but the interesting thing about the date of August 22nd, this summer, on August 22nd, 2009, this image here was just released by a friend of ours, Keith Laney, who actually works for NASA, doing some of the enhancements for them. So I don't know if this was some type of tradition that they were doing, but it's kind of amazing that the new image was released.
A little nod.
This new image shows the entire tail, whereas the image, when we discussed this in the book, we don't have this image available, and the tail is truncated. And we just surmise that there is a full tail. And sure enough, right after our book is released, this picture is released showing the full tail.
How about that? That's really interesting. And do you guys primarily look at images from NASA, or do you look at other space agencies and their material as well?
Well, we've been looking at mostly NASA images, the Mars Global Surveyor, Viking, and the new high-rise, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. The ESA, the Mars Express, the British or the European project, they've released a lot of images. However, they seem to be highly creative in their releases. They're false color and they're very low resolution. They're mostly released for public campaign, you know, for public relations. They're really not anything that's scientific that we could look at. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I haven't spent any time looking at those. I have been focusing on there's such an abundance of material from the Mars Global Surveyor. A person couldn't look at it all in their lifetime, and study them for the types of things that we're looking for. So, that's where my main focus has been.
Mm. And again, Bill, if you can talk a little bit about this, why a civilization would want to create these giant artificial structures that kind of blend in with the natural geological formations in this way. Do you think that's again is because it's easy and some features might be there already and they just have to fill that in, so to speak? Or do you think that even location of some of these sites are of importance as well? Maybe even correlation between one image and another image in another place. Thoughts?
Yes, definitely. There has been found. Richard Hoagland initially did a lot of research on the placement of the structures in Cydonia. He came up with a mathematical picture of exactly how these structures are related in their positioning and their different angles. And interestingly enough, he came up with many Masonic numbers, things that. That numbers that are very important to the Masonic belief system. And I don't know why they are hidden. it's very interesting. One thing is that to put multiple images together in a structure, you can't have complete images. It works best to put multiple images if you only have partial images. And why they're hidden, I don't really know.
Might have something to do with the Popol Vuh.
Well, yeah, George, maybe you want to talk about that.
Well, again, it seems that everything we're finding here explaining the reason that we're finding these structures and their companion faces on different areas of the surface.
Mm-hmm.
The Maya, their creation mythology was based on what they called the Popol Vuh, which was basically the Maya creation story. And the Popol Vuh, the original book of the Maya, according to scriptures, was written long ago, but its site was hidden from the searcher and the thinker. So right from the beginning, the original book that the Maya based their creation on was hidden.
They just don't say why it was hidden.
Right. And we made some speculation in the first book about this idea of a great book being hidden from the searcher and the thinker, where Zachariah Sitchin talks about Marduk, who was exiled from Earth because, you know, he had the rivalry with his brother and he wanted to be the ruler, but you know, he was such a bad boy they had to get rid of him and they put him on Mars. And we speculate a little bit in the first book that possibly when Marduk was exiled to Mars with the Igi, he had them create all of these pictographs all over the surface of Mars while he was there because he had nothing better to do. And that was a blasphemous act against his father because his father had bestowed the sacred writings and everything to his brother. So when Marduk had access to this sacred knowledge, he put basically the mythology of the world on Mars, which was what the Maya saw as the Popol Vuh, this lost book, this hidden book that nobody could see because it was, you know, nobody knew where it was. And possibly the existence of all these geoglyphs all over the planet that we're finding out. Initially, we thought there was just focused in Sidonia area, but they seem to now be all over the place, is that possibly Marduk was creating this holographic book, and Mars is basically this Popol Vuh that was lost.
Do you think that could be for us to be found, so to speak? That it's a message here that when we arrive, technologically speaking, in a time where we have the ability to see this, that's also the time when we're supposed to find the lost book, so to speak.
Right, like Hoagland had said, the face on Mars was a calling card saying, hey, look at here, you know, and that's what we found first. And then through his studies there, he found this, you know, sacred geometry that he was finding, you know, the layout of the structures. And this whole concept of, you know, human beings or whoever these people were building structures that are to be viewed from above, again, you have in North America, the American Indians down in South America. Some of the actual cities in South America, the Peruvian cities, are in shapes of alligators or birds. The interesting thing we found out about this parrot, there's the first city that the Maya built, mentioned in the Popol Vuh, was shaped like a parrot.
Hmm.
And we have a picture of that in the book. And down in Peru and South America, you have cities that are constructed in the shapes of a puma, of a llama, of alligators and things like that. American Indians made all these mounds. You have the Serpent Mound out in Ohio. So it's a tradition that you know, these ancient cultures, for some reason, built these geoglyphs on our planet that could only be viewed from above. Now, most people are familiar with these ancient cultures that built these landforms, these earthworks that could only be viewed from above. While doing this research in the first book, as recently as 2001, they discovered a huge half of a face geoglyph down in Corral, Peru. This was just discovered. There's a whole influx of archaeologists down in southern Peru right now for the last 5-6 years digging in this area called Corral, Peru. And they're dating it. The carbon dating is going way back. It's even rivaling with the age of the pyramids in Egypt.
Hmm.
It's going back almost 3,000 B.C., which is pretty startling.
Wow.
And it's right next to those ruins that they found this half-faced geoglyph, and we have a picture of that in the first book. And again, that's just a half of a face. Just like the things we're finding on Mars, we're finding a parallel here on Earth.
Really interesting, and I guess we have much more to discuss, obviously, but I want to begin to round things up here for the first hour. And maybe one of you can mention a little bit about more about your website, what people can find if they go there, and of course how to get copies of your books as well.
Well, the website's at, like you said, it's the Sedona Institute, all one word, thesedonainstitute.com. On the website, we have numerous articles that either Bill or I or we have written together, and there's up about our appearances and information on the website where your listeners can order the book. The book can also be ordered directly through the Sedona Institute at P.O. Box 102, Percival, Virginia, and that's area code 20132. And they can send us a letter about some information about obtaining a book, if they're interested.
Excellent. Again, the website is thesedoniainstitute.com. We will have this linked up together with the address that George just mentioned on our website, redascreations.com, as well. We're going to take a little break here. So, William and George, stay with us on the line, and we'll be right back after this break with more for our members. Thank you for joining us for Hour 1 with George and William. We'll continue talking more in our members area. We have another hour lined up with more information, specifically about the DNM pyramid, the five-sided pentagonal pyramid on Mars. We talk about some of the different animal structures that they've found, dogs, a rabbit, jaguar, bees, and owls. And these are all images that have symbolic value in different cultures all around the Earth. We discuss what they believe represents a young and an old woman that is referred to as the moon goddess. We talk about the twin hero symbolism and also Masonic symbolism found on Mars. And about NASA, if they are hiding or keeping secret the structures found there. What will happen if they decide to go there? We talk about the secret space program and ask if the Brookings report is correct in the assumption that the impact on human culture would be too great to reveal data on the Mars-Earth connection. We also talk about the Viking connection, some of the Norse mythology, and what is with the name Viking 1 and 2? Why did NASA name their first two spacecrafts that they sent to Mars Viking? We go more into who is behind giving the human race these archetypal symbols, if they are still around, and if they are watching us as we make our way into the solar system. So don't miss Hour 2. If you're not yet a member, click on subscribe to find out how to tune in and get full access to all of our radio programs. We have over 400 hours of radio alone waiting right there for you now. But we also have videos, interviews, webcasts, and film material there as well. Don't miss our latest edition, the Rosicrucian Park Tour, as we go into some of the symbolism of the Amorc, the ancient mystical order of the Rose Cross. We look at their Rosicrucian Park in San Jose, and we discuss their origins, the official stuff, and some of the controversies surrounding the order. Check into our radio archive for upcoming guests, and don't forget to sign up for our free newsletter. RedIceCreations.com is the website. We will be back with more for members after this break.